I want to make sure that we're following this progression, because it really is important for us to understand the nature of the opposition that we can expect to experience as we grow spiritually. So there's that Greek word, sarx. Do remember this, it has both a positive and negative meaning. We do not want to be Greeks in our thinking. Our Greeks tended to denigrate the flesh, they denigrated stuff. They thought that the world of the spirit was where important spiritual matters were dealt with. When I think of flesh, I think of fallen human nature, as we talked about last week. What does it look like? There's that phrase in curvatus sense. That's an important Latin phrase to remember. Curved in on itself. Go back over and review what I had to say about Genesis 3. This is a key question always in the spiritual life. Who are we going to trust? The deep temptation will be to trust ourselves, especially when things get difficult. We'll be tempted to trust ourselves if we judge by appearances. If you remember, St. John Chrysostom teaches us, do not judge by appearances. During those periods of life when they're absolutely wondrous and when we seem to be growing spiritually by leaps and bounds, it's easy to trust God, is it not? Because God seems to be meeting our needs directly. Well, every one of us here, I hate to say this, but every one of us here will one day bury somebody that we deeply love. It's guaranteed. And at that point, the temptation will be to trust ourselves, to think that we know more about whatever that constellation of events is that has brought this particular event to pass. So the fundamental question of the spiritual life is, who am I going to trust? Deeply trust. This is deep trust. This isn't light, momentary. This is that deep, lasting trust. Who am I going to trust my life with? And of course, Christ is absolutely ruthless at this point. For our own sake, trust me. And as we'll see today, what he'll do with people is if someone comes to him and says, I wish to be your disciple, he will take them through a process that's often painful, occasionally discouraging, sometimes filled with wonder and light, in order to form and shape their character in such a way that they become trusting people. This phrase here, salvation, the process of straightening us out, has to do with that in curvatus sense. Someone who's turned in on herself or on himself is just skewed. So from a Christian perspective, now this is different from other perspectives. I was reading the perspective, for example, of a young atheist. And from her perspective, as I read the article about her, she was arguing that human beings are basically good. That's a coherent, defendable position. I don't think it's right. But it's not incoherent. Well, she would say, no, to this diagram. But what I'm arguing is there's something wrong with human nature. It's so serious that God had to enter his own world and take on human nature to straighten it out. Do not forget that phrase in curvatus sense. It's an important one. Then if you remember last class, we were talking about world, flesh, devil. And I believe we got to point number one here. I would like you to remember this phrase, corporate flesh, and to remember that the evil that we're capable of producing is magnified when we gather together in groups. Another point here would be the nature of the evil we produce as groups, as specific cultures, will manifest itself in some ways differently from culture to culture. But it's a transcultural phenomenon. I can go to Africa, and guess what shows up? Corporate flesh. And then I come back to North America. This is, you know, home territory. This is the air I've breathed all my life. And guess what's here too? Corporate flesh, but it manifests itself in a North American manner. always present, however, in some way. Remember that other fruitful metaphor that I gave you last class? Corporate flesh is an unholy force field. You remember that? Unholy force field. I think that's helpful. I'll give an illustration of that in just a moment. Taking a look at just a couple of texts here. Remembering that when Jesus is speaking here, he's not speaking of the world as created by God. He's speaking of the world as distorted, cracked by sin. Two different meanings. Anything by definition created by God is a good thing. We talked about that last class. All right, John 15, verse 18. Christ teaches, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you don't belong to the world, but I've chosen you out of the world. That's why the world hates you. Remember the words that I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you also." Now, the reason for the persecution is simply because of such a direct clash in fundamental values. It's a direct clash in fundamental values that also has a supernatural aspect to it. So it's as though the battle going on and being waged on a supernatural level is also present on a very natural level that skewed itself. So the world in this sense hates what Christ represents because what Christ represents so directly challenges it. Do you remember last class with that quote I had from Loveless? He says that the world, negatively speaking, the world in this sense will reward or applaud certain specific behaviors, and the world in this negative sense will also penalize or deride or find funny or naive or immature certain kinds of behaviors. Take a look over at Romans. Romans chapter 12, I'm going to start with verse 1. Remember this text. "Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship." He could be not less Greek than at that point. Offer your bodies as a spiritual act of worship. And then he goes on and he says here, in this particular translation, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world." Did you catch that phrase? The pattern of this world. What I'd like you to think about deeply would be this. Stay with me. What I'd like you to think about deeply would be this. How does the pattern of this world manifest itself in North American culture? Or how has the pattern of this world manifested itself in my family life? In my own value structures, how does it appear? And it's very hard to identify because it's like the air we've breathed all our lives. It seems normal. At times it seems praiseworthy. It's like as Loveless puts it, it's like an unholy force field pulling on us, stretching us into a foreign mold. You know what comes to mind? J.B. Phillips. J.B. Phillips in the Phillips translation translates Romans 12:2 this way. "Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold." Let's think about that for a minute. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. So positively speaking, if we think of the world as created by God, there's many things about the world that we can enjoy. But when we move into this negative meaning of world as corporate flesh, it's as though there's an unholy force field squeezing against us, pulling against us, pushing against us. It's advocating values. It's advocating behaviors that ultimately lead to death. So I really like what Phillips is saying at that point. How has the world squeezed you into its mold? And part of what spiritual formation involves is increasingly being formed and shaped into a different mold. But it hurts. because it's like the cracking of a bone that needs to be reset. Oftentimes, at this juncture, oftentimes our peer group and the pressure we feel from our peer group, whether it be a national peer group or a peer group of our friends, will appear because we've all been affected by this pressure, and Christ calls us to follow, and we find that our yeses and nos are going to change. You might journal about that. What are my yeses? What are my nos? And now that I'm desiring to be a disciple of Christ, how are they going to have to change? I'm not going to go into great detail about this in my own life, but there was one instance when this came home to me. It was when I was about, when I was about 21, and was with a certain peer group at UCLA in the late 60s, early 70s, and you couldn't find a wilder school at that time than the University of California. So I'm at this particular school, and I have a particular peer group, people I really like and enjoy and love and have had a lot of fun with. And relatively small group, 12, 14 people, I remember one evening. And one of these, it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but one of these young women had introduced me to the wonder of marijuana a while back. And you just can't beat it, I was thinking to myself. And then somehow, over the past few months, I'd entered into a new peer group who I didn't really understand the new peer group. I mean, I'm talking about James, John, Peter, Christ, and so on. That's a different peer group. So I'm in this new peer group with a different set of values. And the new peer group is being very gentle with me, but insisted in some ways that at point A or point B or point C, Chris, you got to start to live differently. And I'm thinking, oh man, this is a hassle. But slowly but surely, thank God, my conscience is actually beginning to kick in. And I'm beginning to think things like this. You know, maybe I shouldn't do behavior A or behavior B or behavior C. Maybe it's not a good idea. Who would have thought? So I remember this very distinctly, is going to this old peer group and realizing how the evening would go. It was on Friday night. It was in Santa Monica. The stars were already out, and we were going to sit down and talk about the great issues of the day, which we frequently would do. So you had the war in Vietnam going on. You had other issues of the day. You had Richard Nixon in the White House. That was a terrible problem. You had any number of things going on. As I'm walking down, looking forward to enjoying the evening in all this many and varied splendor, it was as though Christ said, it was so direct. I really do believe God speaks to people. It was as though he said to me, Chris, you're going to have to tell them something tonight. What you're going to have to tell them is you're not going to smoke grass anymore, and you're going to have to tell them why. And I thought, what? No, no. Not going to do it, don't want to do it, and know what will happen if I do it. They will not be happy. So what I'll do, I'll compromise, I'll go in and not smoke grass, because when I would smoke grass, there was a lot of the behaviors related to it. It just wasn't a good idea. So I'll go in and we'll get involved in some discussion about politics. And then when this is passed around communally, I'll be heavily involved in conversation, and I'll pass it along very quickly and keep heavily involved in conversation, and everything will be fine. But it was so distinct as I walked in. All right, you're going to have to do something, and it's not going to be easy. Boy, did I feel that. I felt lots of different force fields pulling me in different directions. Have you ever felt like that? And I bet you there are about four guys there and there's about eight women. And some of these women knew me really well. And the discussion got started about Vietnam, I believe. Very animated. And someone lit up, I can't even remember the name now. What do you call a marijuana cigarette? A joint, yes! A joint! Ah. A joint! How long it's been. I suppose that's a good thing. So someone lights up a joint. I can see it. I remember it was to my right. It was across the table. And there was someone speaking to me internally, saying something like this. All right, son, you're in a relationship with me. And there's going to be a new set here of values. And I said, I can remember thinking internally, fine, but not right now, later. Thank you. And so they're passing this joint along, and Jesus is embarrassing talking about. And it got to me, because it's just, my faith was like, you could not pour my faith into a thimble. It was smaller than that. And so I really wanted a dragon. So this is being passed along, and it came to me, and it was like again, one of those things, like in Fiddler on the Roof, the movie stops. What are you going to do? If you do this, this will happen. I don't know what will happen if I do this. For the first time in your life, Chris, try to do what you think you should do is right. But if you try to do what you do is right, they're going to get mad, and some of them are going to get really mad. Oh. And so I, movie clicks back in again, and I passed it along, and then I'm really talking, because I don't want anybody to notice. So very opinionated about something, who knows what. And there was a woman sitting to my left across the table. If memory serves me correctly, her name was Connie, and she had been watching me. So I think I'm home free. I think evening's going to be great. Covered all my bases. I did what God wants me to do. I'm still in one piece. Nobody's mad. Wonderful. And Connie says this. I hear it. I still hear it. Chris. Chris. Just like that. Chris. And when you know it, everybody's talking and suddenly it's just quiet. Chris. And I said, yeah. Connie, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I said, I was talking about Vietnam, you know, with Nixon, the stupid. And then she said, no, no, no. And then I knew, someone's going to get a beating. I heard that, no, no, no. What are you doing? And I said, what? Why'd you pass that joint by so quickly? She could not have been more direct. And then the movie stops again. The movie stops again. And I thought, well, you can lie, you can tell the truth, you can live out the hour, you can lose all your friends. I mean, and so have you ever had the experience of really not done too many things that are right, and you really don't know how to explain, and so you just kind of blunder something out, and it sounds just the opposite of what you really wanted to say. And so this is what I said. Well, Connie, I become a Christian. And I don't think it's right to keep smoking marijuana. So I'm going to stop. That's all I said. Now, I could have nuanced it. I could have said it in lots of different ways. It sounds kind of judgmental. It sounds any number of things. All I knew was that was about all I could do at that point. And did I feel the pressure of a peer group? Jeez. I just felt like this. And there were no happy people in that. There was not like anybody saying, oh, praise God. Praise God, he's in the kingdom. Hallelujah. That's not happening. It's just quiet. I'm even looking at my best friends. Back me up here just this once. Smile, anything would be nice. I'm getting nothing. And Connie was a very forthright individual. And I remember, we can probably edit this out of the tape, but this is what she said. I remember she looked at me, and the first words out of her mouth were, "You son of a bitch." Well, I probably have to edit that. You son of a bitch. And I thought, well, that's not too bad. She hadn't finished yet. And then she said, "We know what you're like." I still remember, "We know what you're like. You," and then it got really lively. And this is not going on the tape. "But you, how can you come in here and lay that on us? You." And it just went, it got, and I kept looking for my other friends to say, "He's really not all that bad. He didn't mean to say it that way." Nobody's happy. And I can remember thinking in the back of my mind, this is great. This is great. First time in my life I try to do something right, and I'm going to lose all my friends, and I'm really getting reamed by Connie, who I don't like a heck of a lot, and now I want to really run with her. And it was not a deeply Christian atmosphere, it seemed. And I felt like I'd run into a wall. I was trapped. I'd run into a wall. I didn't know what to do. So I remember I said another really bright thing to say. "Well, I guess I should leave." And I remember she said, "You're damn right you should leave, you little So I drug myself out of that room. And I remember the stars were still out. I remember the dew on the grass. And I remember one of my first prayers at any deep level. And here it was. This is really great. That was part of my prayer. "This is really great. Thanks. This is really great. First time in my life I try to do something right. I just lose all my friends. Great, great, great. Thank you very much." And I'm just walking. I can remember walking along the street wondering, well, that did a lot of good. That did a lot of good. And then longing for, you know, a joint to kind of hide all the pain. She's just a knucklehead. Just a kid trying to know God and loving his friends, but realizing there was a line in the sand and a former yes was going to have to become a no, and it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to turn out. You ever have times like that? This does not always work out this way, but it worked out this way in this case. But this, believe me, does not always work out this way. I was at the wedding of the woman who introduced me to the wonder of marijuana. And there was a revival going on at UCLA, and there were just lots of students coming in the kingdom. It was called the Jesus Movement. Maybe some of you have heard of that. So there's this revival going on. People you just would not believe would ever be interested in God or coming in the kingdom, like me. And I'm at, I'll change her name. I'm at Susan's wedding. And it's in a little church. She's become a believer. It was a small church, a small sanctuary, and underneath there was a room where you could have some cake. And I like wedding cake. And so I'm down there in this little reception area. I remember there were columns in the room supporting the little sanctuary. I remember the walls were yellow and the columns were white. And there's a birthday cake. Yes. Not a birthday cake, a wedding cake. Maybe it was somebody else's birthday, I don't know. But there's a wedding cake. And so I really wanted that wedding cake. And yet, as I head over to get the wedding cake, I look across the room, and there's Connie. And I think, oh, no, she'll ruin everything. She'll get mad again. I know her. I know whereof I speak. And so what I did was, I would kind of flip from pillar to pillar. I had a plan. I'm flitting from pillar to pillar, trying to get to the wedding cake without Connie seeing me. I'm going to get the cake. I'm going to eat the cake. I'm going to leave the reception. There's no scene. So I get the cake, flip, 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 from pillar to pillar. I'm standing across the room, and she sees me. And she has that same look. Right to me. And I'm thinking, well, Susan will surely appreciate this as her reception goes up in smoke. And Connie doesn't say hi. She didn't look so much angry as troubled and puzzled. And she makes her way across the room, and she's right in front of me. Doesn't say hi. You remember that night? And I thought, yep. And I was a little irritated by this time, because I really got chewed out that previous time. So I thought, I might just give some back to her. Let's just have a fist right here. And so she said, well, there's just something I want to tell you. And this is what she said. Well, I figured if somebody like you, I think this was a veiled compliment of some kind. I figured if somebody like you was willing to do something like that, there might be some truth in it. And I was totally taken aback. And I said, really? And then she looked down again with that kind of gritting her teeth look, and she said, yeah. And then she said, I started to go to this little Friday night worship service, who knows what church in Santa Monica, and I'd go and sit in the back row. And I had a look like, don't you dare talk to me. I'm just here visiting. And I just listen. I would just listen. And then here was the line that always makes me smile, she said, gritting her teeth. Yeah, I became a Christian because of what you did that night. And I thought, what? What? Now see, it always doesn't happen that way. I'm going to make that clear. It doesn't always happen that way, but sometimes it does. God can take a knucklehead and speak through a knucklehead. Thank God, right? I'm looking at a lot of knuckleheads just like me. God can speak through any of us. But I knew at that point in time that if I was going to get from point A to point B or point B to point C, there will be places where we will have to move against the grain. So where's he calling me to move against the grain? And when we move against the grain, something will be demanded. Something will be demanded. Because we're really moving against the grain in ourselves. Also, as we move against the grain, there's all kinds of spiritual dangers involved. Among them, for example, pride. Now, I want you to grab Devotional Classics, and I want you to turn to John of the Cross. He writes about what he calls the dark night of the soul. Here's what the dark night is. As he talks about the dark night of the soul, he's speaking of a time that almost all of us will encounter when God, in great love, will remove all the support systems and all the props, anything, how can I put it, secondary, that we have relied on for our sense of God's closeness to us, of God's love for us. During this period, it does not mean that God has in any way left. God is probably closer to us in terms of how God is working than ever before. But it seems, by all appearances, like a dark night. Have you had times when you've really prayed and nothing's happening? You've gone from a time when reading the scripture was like drinking a great Merlot, and now it's like drinking vinegar. It's like drinking sand. It's so dry. And yet, as you look at what's happened circumstantial in your life, it's not as though you're just rampantly running into sin. It seems like you're loving other people the way you always have. It seems like everything else is exactly the same, but it seems like he is gone, removed. That's what John means by the dark night. Now, getting back to what I said about some of the difficulties we can run into, particularly at the beginning of the story of our relationship with Christ. For instance, I could have thought to myself, well, that was rough but exciting. Connie's in the kingdom. Surely then what must happen is every time I choose a yes and say a no, someone else will step into the kingdom. Or I really know now how to talk to people about their sin. That's the gift God's given me, is really let people know. The day of wrath is coming. A fee upon your head. And so on. Well, take a look here. This is section 2. He's got a good sense of humor for someone who writes so much about the dark night. Beginners in the spiritual life are apt to become very diligent in their exercises, in their spiritual disciplines. And I would bet for some of us there probably was a time when we were very disciplined spiritually. Maybe for some of us still so. It's not a bad thing. The danger, however, he says, the great danger for them will to become satisfied with their religious works and with themselves. Now, circle that. That's one of the great dangers of the spiritual life, to become satisfied with ourselves, to think that the work is finished, the work is done, I've got to where I need to be, and now I can start teaching other people. It is easy for them to develop a kind of secret pride, which is the first of the 7 capital sins. Are you familiar with the capital sins? This is in Roman Catholic moral theology, and there's something to it. By capital sins, the church means sins that are particularly deadly, particularly harmful. They damage the human soul. I, for one, do not believe that all sins are the same. Jesus himself taught that all sins were not the same. He said, in speaking of Capernaum and Bethsaida, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah than for you, Bethsaida, and for you, Capernaum, for if I had done the things I did in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. Well, there's no way in the world he can use more or less language if all sins are the same. Think of it this way, too. Say someone wasn't understanding something in class, and you raise your hand, you're not getting something, and my response is, what do you mean you're not getting it? How many times do I have to teach this? You know, I've been watching you the whole class, you're not paying attention. You know, why don't you just leave for the day? Out, that's it. In fact, don't come back. Glad you're gone. Everybody would be going, what's happening? We're not safe. He's lost his mind. Right? Sinful, yes? Would that be sinful? Yes, yes, yes. Of course. Well, what if I'm just sitting here in the front row and I've had a bad day and I pull out a 45, pull it to this guy's head and I just go, boom. That was a very lively illustration, wasn't it? Now, do you get my point? Do you get my point? I want to make sure you understand this. Number one. The smallest sin can separate us from God for all eternity. The smallest. A moment's impatience. Something where just on a bad day, we become angry with somebody just because it feels really good. The smallest sin can separate us from God for all eternity. Having said that, Christ, the Apostle Paul, do distinguish between certain sins and name certain sins as being particularly serious. So when we speak of, St. John here, of capital sins, he's thinking of capital in the sense of a capital crime. What's a capital crime? What verdict does a capital crime carry? It's a death penalty. So they kill the soul. They kill the soul. It's interesting that anger is one of them. That deep-rooted bitterness, that anger that can just corrode us internally, devour us internally. Avarice, wanting somebody else's, what they possess, and feeling like that I'm going to get that, that's mine, it shouldn't be theirs. That's connected to another deadly sin, envy, and so on. So let's go back to the text now. Pride, of course, always near the top of the list. Now look at the description that he gives of these kinds of people. It's very surprising. You wouldn't think that a great saint of the church would write this way or ever say that this could be possible. But John says, such persons become too spiritual. They like to speak of spiritual things all the time. They become content with their own growth. They would prefer to teach rather than to be taught. They condemn others who are not as spiritual as they are. They are like the Pharisee who boasted in himself and despised the publican who was not as spiritual as he. Remember that text? Oh, God, I thank you that I'm not like this tax collector. And you think the man is praying to God, but he's actually praying about himself. The devil will often inflame their fervor so that their pride will grow even greater. They become so spiritual, it's devilish. The devil knows that all of their works and virtues will become valueless, and if unchecked, will become vices, for they begin to do these spiritual exercises to be esteemed by others. They're showing off spiritually. They're purposely planning things out in such a way that someone will see them, or at least know this is a fast day, or yes, I am praying, or whatever it might be, whatever the behavior might be. And then how about this one? They also begin to fear confession to another, for it would ruin their image. So for this person who's very young in the spiritual life and too spiritual, it's all, in a manner of speaking, it's all make-believe. It's not the real thing. It's all done to impress. Look at me. Look how spiritual I am. So when they confess their sins, they make confession in order to make their sins appear less imperfect. They'll beg God to take away their imperfections, but they'll do this only because they want to find inner peace and not for God's sake. It's for this person, think of it this way, it's all about me. It's all about me. So you had monks, for example, in the Egyptian desert who were misinterpreting some of Paul's teaching and were feeling that when Paul speaks about pray without ceasing, that they shouldn't be sleeping, that they should try to stay awake at night and continue to pray all the way through the night, try to get by on 1 or 2 hours of sleep. And they're just going nuts because the human body needs between 6 and 8 hours of sleep. And so you have a great man of the desert, Antony, who's scolding them for not realizing that something as earthy and needful as sleep is itself a spiritual discipline. Would you want to be around these kinds of people? I'd rather go to a Phillies game. I'd rather go to a movie than someone who I know when I sit down next to them, they're going to have to talk about something, in quotation marks now, spiritual, because that's all they've got. But it's a distorted kind of spirituality. It's surely not a spirituality connected to the wonder of God's created world. These folks also have a problem with their feelings. This is section 3. Many of these beginners will also begin to have spiritual greed. Greed, by the way, is the second capital sin, as you see here. They'll become discontented with what God gives them because they don't experience the consolation they think they deserve. They begin reading many books and performing many acts of piety in attempt to gain more and more spiritual consolation. Now catch it. Their hearts grow attached to the feelings they get from their devotional life. They focus on the effect and not on the substance of devotion. That is to say, how many here would be tempted to think, I'm doing well spiritually when I feel good, when I feel like God's speaking to me, when I feel the warmth of the Holy Spirit at work within me, then I'm doing well. But in those dry, arid periods, kind of the suffering times I might call them, we begin to think, oh, I've done something wrong. God must be thousands of miles away. There's something terribly askew here. And God is just being quiet, trying to help a beginner what? Grow up and not be attached to their feelings. All right, turn over to Bernard of Clairvaux now. This will be on the next quiz, I think. He speaks of 4 degrees of love. He's very well known for this. Know every one of them. All right, here's the first degree of love. It's on section 2. The first degree of love is love of self for self's sake. Now note these. Love of self for self's sake. What kind of love is this? It's the natural love that all human beings have for themselves. It's that kind of love for self that we exercise in preserving our life from day to day. You know, I love myself enough not to jump in front of a car coming at me at 90 miles an hour. I want to preserve my life. As he puts it here, this human nature is weak, therefore compelled to love itself and serve itself first. In the human realm, people love themselves for their own sake. This is planted within us. So it's planted within us by God. That normal desire for human preservation. You with me? That's love of self for self's sake. Number 2, section 3. Then we have love of God for self's sake. Love of God for self's sake. What is this? Love of God for self's sake is loving God because of how God has blessed us. See how it's related to the self, that kind of love? God, as he puts it here, God, therefore, who makes everything that is good, makes himself to be loved. He does it as follows. First, God blesses us with his protection. When we live free from trouble, we're happy, but in our pride, we may conclude that we're responsible for our security. Then, when we suffer some calamity, some storm in our lives, we turn to God and ask for his help, calling upon him in times of trouble. This is how we who love ourselves first begin to love God. But that beginning to love God is still related to what God is doing for us. All right? So we have love of self for self's sake, love of self for God's sake. Third degree of love. Love of God for God's sake. And in, how to put this, in love of God for God's sake, we're moving into what I want to call a disinterested love. Disinterested. Now, what disinterested means in this manner is this. We're loving God, but it's disinterested in that our love for God is not predicated on anything God is doing for us. You with me? It's not something that God's doing for us. It's disinterested. It's an elevated love in the sense that we're simply loving God because of the wonder of who God is in his own being. Not because of his relationship to us or something he's doing for us. All right? Does that make sense? It's disinterested. It's a more elevated kind of love. It's moving beyond the self. Now, and then we have the fourth love. Love of self for God's sake. Now, this is the hardest one to understand. Love of self for God's sake. And he calls this kind of love contemplative love. Contemplative love. This is a love that draws us out of ourselves. draws us out of ourselves. So in that sense, it's both disinterested, but we're really leaving the self behind now because of the wonder of what we're seeing. This kind of love is very rare. And as Bernard puts it, very few people ever enter into this state of love. But it's something like this. So imagine you're with James and John and Peter, and you're heading up the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus, and suddenly he's transfigured. And you have never, ever seen anything that looks like that, the transfigured Christ. And the wonder of what you see is so full and wonder-filled, you're taken out of yourself. You're taken out of yourself. At that point in time, you're not thinking about, you know, I wonder if I'm going to go to the game today. I wonder when the class is going to end. I wonder that you are taken out of yourself in your contemplation of what you're seeing and the beauty of what you're seeing. That's what Bernard means by contemplation. In that contemplative state, what you see is often indescribable. That's that fourth degree of love. The fourth degree of love. It's the highest degree of love. I would bet it's the kind of love that you'll experience when you enter a new heavens and a new earth. Maybe in that, at the moment of your death, that first instance when you realize, oh my goodness, you know, I'm dead. Well, who would have thought? But very quickly, you realize you're surrounded by realities. Realities where you're not thinking about yourself, you're thinking about the wonder of what you're seeing. And you're being pulled out of yourself. That's the highest degree of love. Now, I'm sure that there's many who have experienced it, but it's not all that common. Bernard did, St. John of the Cross did. But it's the fruit, catch it, it's the fruit of the first three. It's the fruit of the first three. And its characteristic is we are not focused on ourselves. We're not focused on ourselves. We're drawn out. We leave ourselves behind in some way. Do you have other things you want to talk about? All right. Have a good day.